You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
It's very important to stress that after the last emperor, Nicholas II, abdicated, there was a provisional government formed in Russia, and it was very influenced by the ideas of Tolstoy, by the ideas of nonviolent resistance.
You were the head of an independent TV network. That's not something very common, as I understand it, in today's Russia.
We have a great culture and great history of fight for freedom and human rights, and we can be proud of. Our civil society had some really impressive victories, and finally, in the year 1991, that was Russian people who took over.
Mikhail Zagar is a Russian journalist, writer, and filmmaker, and the founding editor-in-chief of the only Russian independent TV news channel, Doshed TV, or TV Rain. He is the author of The Empire Must Die, Russia's Revolutionary Collapse, 1900 to 1917. And he joins me on the program now. Mikhail, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
It is always fascinating. America is always fascinated by Russia. It's a country as vast as our own. It's somewhat mysterious since the American Revolution, when we sent diplomats, Francis Dana, over to see Catherine the Great for support. Thomas Jefferson called it the world power most friendly to America. During the Civil War, Lincoln praised how much Russia had supported us in the Union side, and it still fascinates us today. And of course, Russia is in our politics. It's the 100-year anniversary of the Russian Revolution. You have written a very interesting book, The Empire Must Die, about an interpretation of that revolution. I wish you would talk about the common history of the Russian Revolution, now 100 years old, 1917, and how your view of that history is different.
You know, as you've started with prominent American historical figures and their approach to Russia, I would also like to start with underlining some most important things about how America influenced Russian Revolution, and how Russian Revolution was impossible without American influence. Because in the beginning of the last century, of the 20th century, a lot of prominent Russian politicians, revolutionaries, and leaders of civil society were greatly influenced by American democracy. The author of the first Russian constitution, former Russian Prime Minister Sergei Vita, spent a couple of months of year 1905 in the state of New York, because he was the head of a Russian team of negotiators after the end of the war between Russia and Japan. American President Theodore Roosevelt was mediator during those negotiations. And that is America, where Prime Minister Vita took the inspiration to come back and to propose the first version of the Russian Revolution. All the greatest leaders of and proponents of Russian revolutions, such as worldwide known writer Maxim Gorky, or the founder of the Party of Socialist Revolutionaries, Gregory Gershuni, were traveling across the United States trying to fundraising for the revolution, and some of them did that very successfully. That was actually New York, where Leon Trotsky learned for the first time that the Russian Empire collapsed, and that the last emperor, Nicholas II, abdicated. And he returned to St. Petersburg from the New York City. So the impact of American freedom of speech, American democracy, and of American political situation to Russian civil society that time was really important. And a lot of things that we knew that actually our attitude to the history of Russian Revolution of 1917, all the information most of Russians had were based on the traditional Soviet history, different books, texts written during the Soviet period of our history, and they were not completely precise. They were mostly focused on the role of Lenin, as well as a lot of texts written by non-Russian authors. They also suffer from that Lenin-focused version of the revolution history. It's always described as the communist revolution, although Lenin and communists were not the leading figures of that revolution. Actually, until summer of 1917, it was much different, and Lenin was only a marginal figure in that political process. He was not important. He was not even popular. Bolshevik Party did not exist until summer 1917. On the contrary, until that year, the political struggle in Russia was very tense. The Russian civil society was really very developed, and there were a lot of political parties that were trying hard to achieve some more political influence and to build a strong civil society, to build the social institutions that could influence the emperor's government. A lot of those facts and just that political process is not known by many historians, and especially by the general audience in Russia and outside of Russia as well. So my book is much more a history of Russian civil society. It's not focused on it's not the version of the history that is written by the winners, meaning the communists. It's about the what was really happening, what was important for those people who lived in Russia before 1917, how they perceived and how they judged what was happening in Russia those days.
Talk a bit about the Russo-Japanese War and a revolution that occurred in 1905 and the World War I debacle of the Russian war effort in 1917 and the revolution there. In a lot of American history, where we talk about the Russian Revolution, I'm afraid it's oddly enough influenced by that Soviet version. A lot of Americans just simply think, well, there was the Tsar was toppled, and then the Bolsheviks took over. Talk more about maybe that earlier history and the run-up to World War One.
Yeah, that's really important, because not much of us, especially not many Russians, know that in the beginning of 20th century, Russia was probably one of the most culturally influential countries in the world, and probably one of the most popular culturally, because Russian literature, Russian with Tolstoy and Chekhov still alive in the beginning of that century, or Russian theater, or Russian music, or Russian painters were really famous all around the world. As probably I might quote one of the early novels of British writer Somerset Maugham, who was describing the young Londoner who was trying hard to pretend that he was Russian, because that was very fashionable. And he was reading Russian writers and buying Russian paintings for his house. That was really important, that Russia was a very progressive country. At the same time, there was a very crisis, severe conflict between Russian government and Russian civil society, because the Emperor Nicholas II was not the genius political strategist. On the contrary, he was the man who sincerely believed that his destiny to be the only man responsible for the political process in his country. He was taught by his tutors from this childhood, and he was supported by his wife, Empress Alexandra, who was also a rather stubborn woman, who considered that any attempt of Russian civil society to interfere decision-making process is directed against her son, because that's going to be his property after he becomes the next Russian emperor. And she was fighting like a truly loving mother against any attempt of any opposition leader, any opposition party, with the trying and pushing for more reforms. At the same time, there was very important political crisis that happened right after the Russo-Japanese War in 1905 that led to almost the revolution. It is still called the Revolution of 1905. Emperor was nearly deposed. He was locked up in a suburb of St. Petersburg called Peterhof, and he could not get in touch with his own government or his own capital. There was a German warship that entered the Baltic Sea. It was very close to the Russian capital. But the objective of German emperor and the German military was to help Emperor Nicholas II to evacuate from Russia. And he proposed that German troops could invade Russian capital and suppress that revolution. Finally, although most of the royal family wanted to agree and wanted to use the proposal of German emperor, that was only the Prime Minister Sergei Witte, who has just returned from America, who had another option in his mind. He proposed the constitution, and he has written the text of the new constitution that introduced the parliament. So since the year 1906, there was another political system that existed in Russia, and it was much more a parliamentarian monarchy. Although for Nicholas II, he never truly believed that was the right thing to do. He thought that he was forced to accept the parliament. He was forced by Prime Minister Witte, and that was the moment of his weakness. And he thought that he betrayed something really sacred. He really believed in that was his death before the God. That he was the only man who was capable and responsible to take all the political decisions. The next decade was really, on the one hand, rather prosperous time for Russia. At the same time, that was the years of despair. Although the new political system was introduced, but there was a decade of repressions against the leaders of civil society. A lot of them had to flee the country. A lot of them immigrated to Germany or Switzerland or France, or some of them to America. These were lavish, luxurious years of Russian history. Russia was famous in Europe not only because of art and literature and theater, but because of the way of life of Russian grand dukes and grand duchess, who were able to rent the most luxurious villas, the most posh hotels all around Europe, and partying like Russians was infamous way of life for that decade. Actually, it reminds a bit the image of Russia and the political atmosphere of Russia in the first decade of 21st century. I cannot neglect that parallel.
Yeah, it seems like in telling the story of this, the lead up to the Russian Revolution and a bit of the aftermath, you're hinting that there's a closeness to events in Russia today. you were the head of an independent TV network. That's not something very common, as I understand it, in today's Russia. And talk a bit about the atmosphere today in terms of, say, speech, in terms of, say, differences between elites and common people.
You know, in those terms, there is no much difference between Russia 100 years, especially, I would say, during the first decade of the 20th century and Russia today, because we still have a rather polarized society. We still have a lot of people who really think that Russia should be a decent, democratic, free country, and we need normal democratic institutions that could allow our country become a stable and economically developed country. At the same time, there is a lot of prejudice against that way of thinking inside Russian bureaucracy. The large part of Russian society is obsessed with talking that Western values are not for Russia, that Russia has got some traditional core values, that and according to those values, Russia should be much more authoritarian than any other country, that Russia needs, if not a czar, but Russia needs a strong leader. That's the only way how the country could be managed. And that's, you know, the main value for that probably slightly larger part of Russian population, and especially those ideas are popular among Russian ruling class, among Russian bureaucracy, that the main traditional value is that Russia is an empire itself. And a lot of people should be proud of Russia as a superpower, Russia as an empire.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Many times when in recent news events, when we're trying to explain or understand, say, Vladimir Putin's actions, it's been explained to us by some that some of the actions he takes is to put Russia back on the stage, or that he feels that Russian pride might be offended, or that America is treating him like a small person. So some of the things he's doing is to make him a big person, to make Russia a big country. And to some, I wonder how true it is, because it almost seems like it might be a naive interpretation. What do you think about that?
If we speak about Vladimir Putin's perception and the last two or three decades of Russian history after the collapse of the Soviet Union, these were the most difficult decades for many Russians, especially psychologically, because after the collapse of the Soviet Union, a lot of Russian people felt some kind of deep psychological trauma. And the 90s were very economically hard for our people, and especially many people felt humiliated because they lost everything. They lost their income, they lost some high living standards, they lost any hope and feeling of certainty. At the same time, they lost that feeling of national pride. They were not respected globally. That was probably if the economic situation was better, that wouldn't be felt in that way. But that was a mixture of all different feelings of being humiliated, and that's why probably for many people, feeling of national pride is still very important. From the very beginning of his first presidential term, that was really important objective for Vladimir Putin when he was trying to make friends with his Western partners like George W. Bush or Tony Blair. He was trying to feel treated as an equal partner, treated with respect. And I must say that during his first presidential term, Putin was really probably the most pro-Western leader that Russia has ever had. He was even proposing that Russia could join NATO. That was unprecedented for Russian president. But actually those projects were not really successful. They actually a bit contradicted the perception of American administration. For George W. Bush, Russia was never a great empire. He considered Russia much more another European country, probably something like bigger Finland, but not as an empire or a superpower. So that was a long process for Vladimir Putin when he really felt not respected the way he wanted to be respected, when he was really offended when he learned that George W. Bush decided to start Iraqi war from the media, not from himself. Then Vladimir Putin started being paranoid when his aides started telling him that there is some kind of conspiracy and American administration is trying to install the new government in Ukraine. There were so-called color revolutions in some republics of ex-Soviet Union, and Vladimir Putin was becoming much more and more paranoid. So to some extent, there is some truth in that perception that the key ambition of Vladimir Putin is to feel that he is really internationally important. He wants to become some kind of a member of the world or the world. That's a very popular phrase in Kremlin, that Russia needs to be a stakeholder of the world. And he, Vladimir Putin himself, wants to have like a permanent seat in that board of directors. That is, he has been trying to achieve for many years. And now it seems like he's feeling that he has finally achieved that.
Yeah, it seems like he got his favored choice from the 2016 election, that he preferred Donald Trump to win rather than Hillary Clinton. At least that's something commonly asserted here in the U.S.
Definitely, if he was to choose between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, he would have preferred Donald Trump, because to his mind that's the man he could deal with. But at the same time, I must tell you that in weeks before American elections, all the most of the members of Putin's inner circle were absolutely sure that Hillary Clinton was to win, and they had no doubts in that, and they already started preparing for the future negotiations with Hillary Clinton as the new American president, and they were trying to impress her as the new head of American foreign policy, and that was rather a surprise for them when it turned out that they were wrong, and the new president was going to be Donald Trump.
And I should point out that as we're discussing current politics, that as you are the author of The Empire Must Die, and it's this really interesting and large book about Russian history. I have to mention, by the way, having read the book, and I'm still finishing it because it is large and it's so interesting, that it's all these little stories, and it's broken up in nice little sub-chapters so that you can almost like pick up at different points and read about very interesting characters. But you're also the author of All the Kremlin's Men, which is a story about the journalism about the Vladimir Putin and the people around him. So I think you're well qualified to discuss what's going on. In other words, you had many conversations with people that work with Putin, and you have many sources over many years.
Yeah, that was true. Actually, I spent 7 years writing All the Kremlin's Men. I was trying to interview as many people from Putin's inner circle, or Russian oligarchs, or members of Russian parliament, or Russian government as I could. Most of those interviews were off the record interviews, but that's even better way to make them be more sincere. So I really think I still have some possibility to understand what people from Putin's inner circle are thinking. At the same time, I must tell you that it seems to me that Putin's role, Putin's personal role in Russia and in America as well, is a bit exaggerated. He is a bit idealized by American media, because usually he's portrayed as a genius mastermind of the global conspiracy,
right,
as the master of puppets who controls the world and who can impose his own will to American people and implant his handpicked candidate as the new American president. That does not look reasonable for me. Putin is not a strategic player. He is much more a tactical player. He's often reacting to what's happening. He replies to the circumstances. He always changes his plans. Russian leadership is much more chaotic than it's supposed to be, and than it's described in many American media.
Go back a bit to the history of the Russian Revolution and the subject of your book, The Empire Must Die, and because you really describe in the book, the whole idea of the book is there was this moment where perhaps Russia could have had more democracy. And a figure that Americans aren't familiar with, I'm sure Russians are, but Americans aren't familiar enough with, would be Alexander Kerensky. Would it be appropriate to talk a bit about him?
Definitely, but not only about him. You know, I cannot agree with you when you're saying that Russians probably know about that. Unfortunately, Russians don't know about that. That's a stereotype shared by many Russians that, ironically, there was Nicholas II, and then Bolsheviks came and took the power. The whole period of Russian history from, let's say, February 1917 till October 1917 is missing. It has never been discussed in history textbooks, especially because they were written in a way to please Lenin and Communist Party. That's important. That's very important to stress that after the last emperor, Nicholas II, abdicated, there was a provisional government formed in Russia, and it was very influenced by the ideas of Tolstoy, by the ideas of nonviolent resistance. The first prime minister of Russian Republic was the man whose name was Georgi Lvov, or George Lvov, something like Russian George Washington. Unfortunately, he was not running the country for that long. He resigned in July 1917, but he was probably the most democratic leader Russia has ever had, and the most decent man. Under his leadership, Russia became the historically most progressive country for that time. Russia was the first country in the world to abolish death penalty. Russia was the first country in Europe to give women voting rights. And actually, the first months after February Revolution were really the months of democratic euphoria for Russian civil society. Unfortunately, a lot of problems were not solved. The economic situation was really was troublesome. There was a huge economic crisis, and the war was still going on. And another important political leader you've just mentioned, Alexander Kerensky, who first was the Minister of Justice in the Provisional Government, then became the second Prime Minister of Russian Republic. And he is a very good speaker, is a very popular politician.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Did his best to persuade the army to continue the offensive. That was his promise to the allies. And actually, that offensive of Russian army against the German and Austrian troops initially was very successful. But that was probably the last thing that Russian Provisional Government could do, because it ended up with a lot of soldiers deserting and leaving their positions. Then the very successful offensive of German army followed, and actually that June and July of 1917 were the beginning of the end of Russian Democratic Republic, because there was a man whose name was Vladimir Lenin, and he was no famous politician before that. He was not an influential leader. He could be called like enfant terrible of Russian revolutionary parties, because he was always quarreling with his comrades. He was always very unsatisfied and unhappy with everything happening. And he was probably the only politician who was not happy because of the revolution of February 1917. He was the only man to demand the new revolution, to overthrow the new democratic government, because he thought that it did not fit the Marxist standards. Initially, he was the only one to share this vision, but after all those economic and military problems, after different corruption scandals, after the government was not quick enough to implement the necessary reforms, the number of followers of Lenin, especially among the marginal parts of Russian society, especially among working class or soldiers deserting from the army, were growing and growing. And that is important, that Lenin was the only pacifist, the only well-known politician who was demanding to stop the war.
I mean, the war was popular generally. The war or anti-German sentiment was popular in Russia, was it not?
You know, it was popular in the beginning. By the year 1917, most of the society was tired of that war. But still, a lot of people thought that was necessary to end the war and to win the war. That defeated Russia could not be a proper democratic country. That Russia should win that war, and after that, a lot of things are going to be much easier. So, unfortunately, that person, Vladimir Lenin, who was criticizing every step of the provisional government, was clever enough to mobilize the most marginal people in Russian capital. He was so, although not an experienced politician before that, he was a populist, and he managed to organize a coup that we know as the October Revolution.
And his ideas must have attracted support from the people on the ground. The idea of the concept of communism must have been attractive for some of the common people who were coming back from war or seeing their food supplies empty.
Yeah, a lot of his followers didn't know what communism was like, but his major slogans were to stop the war and to give all the plants and factories to the workers and to give all the land to the peasants. As we know, none of those promises were fulfilled, because immediately after he announced that he was going to stop the war did not stop. Otherwise, there was a huge civil war that ended only in 1922. The peasants did not get any land. There was a lot of purges and repressions against the peasants, and there were so-called kolkhozes organized all across Russia. And the same happened with the factories and plants. They after the revolution belonged to the state, but not to the workers.
This could be my own bias, my American bias in viewing Russian history. But there's so many dark moments. There's the 1905 revolution. There's the 1917 revolution. The World War One. An experience, the experience of communism over the 70 years of leaders that don't seem to have people's interest at heart, and difficulty with democracy and throughout a long period. But is that view that Russian history is perhaps very dark, is it justified? What's it like to be Russian in reality?
No, I think that's still a prejudice, and rather offensive prejudice, probably. I don't think that most of Russians would be happy to hear that. On the contrary, we unfortunately have a history focused on Russian state, not on Russian civil society, and even more, the traditional version of Russian history is focused on Russian rulers. It tells us that Russia has always been a great empire, and we must be proud of its strength. But at the same time, if we might focus on Russian society for many centuries of our history, we had a great culture and great Russian society, and a lot of people throughout all of our history who were struggling for their freedoms, for the freedom of speech, for the freedom of choice, for the freedom of religion. I must mention probably Leo Tolstoy, who is one of the most well-known writers globally, but not many people know that he was not only a novelist, but also a political leader, a philosopher, and like a spiritual leader of the Russian opposition. And that were his ideas who inspired Mahatma Gandhi and then Martin Luther King. So that's also very important for many Russians, that we have a great culture and great history of fight for freedom and human rights, and we can be proud of that as well. We know that our civil society had some really impressive victories, and finally, in the year 1991, that was Russian people who took over. The Cold War ended not because Americans won that war. It was a victory of Russian people. That were Russian people who defeated the totalitarianism, that was Russian people who won when there was an attempt of coup of old Soviet elite in August of 1991, and that attempt was defeated by huge protest rallies in Moscow and St. Petersburg. So that was a huge victory of Russian people that wanted their country to be a free country. And I will never agree that Russia has got some darker history than any other country in the world. I will never agree with that prejudice that is shared by some Russians, mm-hmm. even that Russia is not a country that can be democratic and free. I will never agree that Russia's destiny is to be a monarchy, an empire, or a dictatorship. And at least we've got one proof for that, and that is our history.
Even during the Soviet period, there was a lot of writing and a lot of literature and a lot of expression. It's quite a rich literature that's, I think, always been a hallmark of Russia. It's a tremendous contribution to the culture, to those who are willing to open the box and look at it.
Yeah, definitely. And let's see, if we look to the not to the history that happened 100 years ago, but what happened 50 years ago in the year 1968, that was a crucial year for American history and for Soviet history as well. Approximately the same time when Martin Luther King was assassinated, academician Andrei Sakharov started his activity as a champion of human rights and one of the greatest proponents of human rights in the world. At the same time, although there was official censorship in the Soviet Union, but the new and very important underground media was established the same year. It was called Chronicle of Current Affairs. It was tape written by ordinary people, but the number of copies of that illegal newspaper was tremendous. And let's say when there was peak of anti-war protests here in America during the National Democratic Convention in Chicago in August 1968, at the same time, there was a very historical demonstration against Soviet invasion in Prague. And 8 people participated in that historic demonstration on the Red Square protesting against Soviet invasion in Czechoslovakia. That's a very important coincidence that happened the same day when the demonstrations in Chicago were booming. So we also have very, like, I must say that there are very interesting parallels in that terms between Russian and American history.
And I've been speaking with the author of The Empire Must Die, Mikhail Zagar, Russia's Revolutionary Collapse, 1900 to 1917. Thanks for coming on the program. I always ask guests this. Is there something else that we didn't get to that you think is an important point?
I think that would be rather interesting for your listeners to read the book that we've been discussing, because I was writing it not for those who love history. The story itself is very interesting, and it's very important to it's my attempt to help people to get to know those important personalities that lived 100 years ago. And I'm always saying that history is some kind of rehearsal of the present, and that's the only way for us to try to get prepared for the troubles that are awaiting us in the future.
Great, and we do thank you for coming on the program today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I've been speaking with Mikhail Zagar, the author of The Empire Must Die, Russia's Revolutionary Collapse, 1900 to 1917. I want to thank you for listening. The premium podcast is available at www.myhistorycanbeatupyourpoliticspremium.com. consider signing up. It can be as little as $2 a month. Help support the show, and also you'll get bonus episodes.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.